Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here again. Mark mentioned 3 years ago we had a similar meeting, a smaller gathering than this, and I forewarned him that some of what I'm going to say I said 3 years ago, I need to say it again just to build the story. And he said, well, there's a saying in mathematics that you either need a new paradigm or you need a new audience. And I think we have a combination of the two. But I'm going to my talk will serve as a prelude, if you like, to the next couple of speakers as well, and you'll get locusts for much of the morning in one way or another, along with other things. And we'll begin by showing a short video clip which demonstrates what this particular species, the desert locust, is best known for, and that is forming massive swarms. Now it, along with a dozen or so other species of grasshopper, are called locusts because they demonstrate this sort of swarming behaviour, in which they occasionally yet catastrophically come together in these vast numbers and produce huge swarms of animals, in this case adults, that move through the habitat, destroying as they go the vegetation. They will also form marching bands as immatures or hoppers. And in this species, these sorts of swarms can invade an area that cuts across the whole of North Africa, through into the Middle East, and then into Western India and Pakistan, an area that's about 20% of the Earth's surface. Now that's the popular view, or the typical view of this species, the desert locust. This is the animal of biblical fame. But normally you'd never find one. They live at very, very low population densities across much of North Africa. And even if you did find one, you probably wouldn't know what it was, because it would look quite different. And the reason that is because this species, along with other locusts, is defined by a particular critical piece of biology, and that is that it demonstrates what's known as density-dependent polyphenism, or phase change, such that were you to rear the animals at high density, as you see here in the field in Mauritania, or here in the lab, it'll grow up looking like this. And this is a final stage immature, and it's demonstrating what's known as its gregarious phase characteristics, or it belongs to phase gregaria. Were you, on the other hand, to rear them in isolation, in fact, that exact same animal were it to have been reared on its own, as we have here in the Oxford solitary locust culture, it would grow up looking like this. An entirely different looking animal, and not just an entirely differently looking animal, one that differs from its other phase, the gregarious phase, in a whole range of different characteristics. And there's just some of them there. These are all continuous traits. In other words, the animals can exist in either that extreme, or in any variance in between, and they're coupled rather loosely at the level of underlying mechanisms. Some of them share similar mechanisms of control, others don't. But by far and away the most important with respect to the phenomenon of swarming is the behavioural trait, the fact that these animals show a difference in behaviour that accompanies this phase transition. Now, behaviour, as I shall develop throughout this talk, serves as the engine of phase change, both within the individual and across the population. And what we've done, and this is where I'm going to reiterate some of the older story, is to try to begin by understanding the temporal dynamics of behavioural phase change, the rate at which they change their behaviour from one to the other when they experience crowding or lack of it, and then go on to show how that, an understanding of that behavioural change and its dynamics, can serve as a high resolution correlate for studying the underlying mechanisms of the process, and also allow us to develop individual-based models for exploring the population-level processes that go on when animals, locusts, interact with their environment, and try and understand the process of swarming through that. And, of course, the building of these models relies on an understanding of the mechanisms of the process. Well, the very first thing we needed to do was to actually develop a way of quantifying the behavioural phase state of individual animals. And to do that, we still do provide a simple assay in which we have a test animal put into an arena and an observer sits and records the behavior of that test animal as it responds to a crowd of other locusts. And during the 10 minutes of that assay, the person will record virtually everything the animal does, and it demonstrates a whole suite of different behaviors. And from that, using multiple logistic regression, what we can do is to combine and weight the various behavioral variables that are recorded into a model that best separates animals of known solitarious and gregarious rearing, crowd rearing and isolated rearing. And when you do that, you find that there's a suite of behaviours that typify animals that are in the gregarious behavioural state. They walk towards others, they're attracted by each other, in other words. They walk rather more quickly than this phase. They turn more often, they groom more frequently when they're in the assay. And if you put them together, they march collectively. They start to show a very obvious collective behaviour. In contrast, when they're in this solitarious phase state, they behave very cryptically. They freeze and creep away from others. They walk very slowly, very cautiously. They turn less, they groom less frequently. So it's very easy to typify the two different phase states. And having done that, what you can then do is to take an animal of indeterminate phase state, something that you've subjected to a particular experimental treatment, for example. You can measure its behavior in the same assay, and then plug its behavioral variables into the model and essentially ask the question, well, what are you? If the outcome is that the probability is considered to be 100% of it behaving solitariously, it means that in the assay, its behavior is indistinguishable from that of a typical solitary reared animal. If, on the other hand, you get a value for probability solitary of 0, it's behaving indistinguishably from a crowd-reared gregarious animal. Or it could be anywhere in the middle. And this provides our dependent variable that we then use in experimental manipulations. Now, the first thing we did was to actually quantify the time course of behavioral phase change. So what happens, for example, if you take a solitarious locust and you put it in a group? So you can test the behavior of the animal by basically putting it in the assay first before it's crowded, recording its behavioral phase state, putting it back in the group, leaving it a bit longer, recording it again, and so on. And then that way, you can plot the change in behavioral phase state over time of crowding. Now, on my axes for many of the data graphs that are going to come over the next 10 minutes or so, you'll see values running from 1 to 0, and this is the probability of being considered solitary. Solitarious at the top, gregarious at the bottom. And what you'll see, of course, is that the animal at the beginning was considered, on average, these animals were considered to be solitarious, but within only an hour or two of being crowded, they had flipped into the other behavioural state. So they're now starting to be attracted by rather than repelled by other locusts. So it's a very rapid transition. If you re-isolate that animal, so you put it in a group, you gregarize it and then put it back on its own again, you can ask the question, well, how quickly does it lose those gregarious behavioral characteristics? And the answer is it loses them really rather quickly. So within a matter, again, of a couple of hours, it's reassumed solitarious behavior. It's now repelled by others rather than being attracted by them. It wouldn't march.
Do they change any of their morphology too, or is it just behavior?
The behavioural change is very rapid. You couldn't tell morphologically that they had changed. Those changes take substantially longer to happen. Now, that would be remarkable if they change colour as well. That doesn't happen. It's the behaviour is the very first thing to change. Okay. But there's an asymmetry. I've just shown you how you acquire gregarious characteristics very quickly and how you lose them when you get put back on your own. But if you were to take a fully gregarious animal and isolate it, what you would find is that initially it would become more solitary in its behaviour, but only up to a point. And it would remain in that transitional behavioural state for for as long as it remained in that life stage. So when it next comes to molt, it will become more solitarious, but it's sort of stuck at that level for the rest of that particular developmental stage. And in fact, what you find is that that stepwise increase in solitariousness with continued isolation accumulates not only during its own development, but also across generations. And I'll come back to that story in a little bit, such that the mother can influence the behavioral state of her hatchlings according to her own experience. So what you find then is that at the acquisition of behavioral change is very rapid. If you're put in a crowd, you'll swap from avoiding to being attracted by other locusts within a matter of a couple of hours. If you're put back on your own, you lose that again equally rapidly, up to a point which is a function of how long you were previously had spent in the crowd. But what stimuli caused that change? That was a very obvious question that we started asking. And if you think about it, it could be one of four things, really. It could be the sight of other locusts that causes this change. It could be the smell of other locusts, or it could be contact with other locusts. We know it isn't the sound of other locusts, so I won't continue on with that one. But we started an experiment in which we teased apart those three and looked at their various interactions with each other. And to do that, we took a test animal and put it in a box, a clear plastic box, within a larger plastic box, and to simulate the visual presence of other locusts, we put crowd-reared locusts around the outside such that they couldn't be contacted or smelt by the test animal, but they could be seen. To simulate the smell of other locusts, we passed air which was either clean air or air that had gone through a conical flask full of other locusts in the middle. And to simulate physical contact, we used rolling paper balls, which were placed in with the test animal, and because the whole thing was tilted backwards and forwards, it was buffeted by paper balls. And we did that for 4 hours and asked the question at the end, well, how have you changed behaviorally? And this is the answer. If the animal hadn't been subjected to any of those, it was just left on its own, no visual, olfactory, or tactile stimuli, it remained fully solitarious in its behavior. If it had seen others but not smelt or touched the paper balls, it remained solitarious in its behavior. Similarly, if it had only smelt other locusts, it didn't change either. But if you put both the sight and the smell of other locusts together, you got behavioral gregarization. And this is the critical point, if you rolled paper balls at them for 4 hours, they were fully gregarious at the end. In other words, mechanical contact, in this case with rolling paper balls, was sufficient to produce the complete switch within 4 hours in behavior. Well, locusts, like many animals, are covered in tactile receptors. They have touch receptors all over their bodies. They're well endowed with sensory hairs, for example. And the question then arose, well, does it matter where you're touched on your body as to whether or not you change? And to answer that question, we spent many happy hours tickling locusts on various body regions with paintbrushes. And as a result of that, derived a map of the body surface. In fact, we had 13 different body regions that were stroked for 5 seconds a minute over a period of 4 hours. And at the end of that 4 hours, the animals were assessed in the behavioral assay. And the striking thing that came out was that the only place on the body which induced complete gregarization was the hind femur. And you could touch a single hind femur for 5 seconds a minute for 4 hours. In fact, it's less than that. We now know it's only an hour or 2 hours will do it. And you would get complete behavioral switch. In fact, if you took the hind leg and you painted it over with paint so that you immobilized the tactile hairs on the hind femur and then you stroked it, then you got no effect. But if you only painted quarters or halves of the leg, you could actually find that just stroking one quarter of the leg was sufficient to induce full behavioral gregarization. And in fact, of the different quartiles, if you imagine dividing that leg up into four pieces, stroking this bit produced complete behavioral gregorization, as did that bit, and that produced nearly complete behavioral gregorization. The only bit that didn't was just underneath here. So you can regionalize to a very small area on the leg the key stimuli that are inducing this behavioral change. And this is an aspect that has advanced substantially in the past 3 years, but I'm not going to go into because I don't have the time. What that allowed us to do was to then start exploring the underlying neurophysiology and neurochemistry, and we're moving now towards the molecular genetics of phase change. So, for example, we found that if you dissect the animal and you cut or electrically stimulate particular nerve branches, you can isolate which are the nerve branches carrying the critical information back into the nervous system. We also know that through electrically stimulating particular leg nerves, we get changes in neurochemistry in regions of the nervous system, which are now, we understand, accompanied with changes in neural circuitry, which is underpinning the behavior that we're seeing at the level of the whole organism. But I'm not going to go into that. I've got more exciting things to tell you. Now, the other aspect that I did allude to just earlier is that there's a change or transfer of this information across generations. And the mother actually has the capacity, through her own experience of crowding, to influence the behavior of her developing embryos such that the babies enter the world in an appropriate behavioral state. And here's one experiment that demonstrates what I'm talking about. What we did here was measure the behavior of the very young hatchlings that emerge from the eggs that the female lays in the soil, having subjected the mother to a brief period of crowding for 48 hours at one of several stages during her adult life. And essentially what you'll find is that if you look at a fully solitary reared female who's never been crowded, then she produces fully solitary behaving babies. A fully crowd-reared female will produce fully crowd-reared babies. But if you took a solitary-reared female and you crowded her for 2 days when she was just herself 2 days old as a new adult, or a week old, or 14 days, or 21 or 28 days old as a new adult, she lays the eggs on about day 30, then what you'll see is the recency with which she was crowded is translated into the behavior of the hatchlings, such that if she was crowded very recently, just a few days ago, or indeed we know at the time when she lays her eggs, then she does something that produces gregarious hatchlings when they emerge. If she was crowded a week ago and then put back on her own, the effect is marginal, transitional, and then the longer ago she was crowded, the less the effect. So this is, in very real sense, this is a memory of when she was last crowded. So the female is using her own memory of crowding to influence the development of her offspring such that they enter the world behaving in the appropriate way. If she's recently crowded, she produces hatchlings that will behave in a manner appropriate to being in a high-density population. And we went on to show, and again, I'm not going to go into the details of this, but the way she does this is by adding a chemical to the egg foam which surrounds the eggs when she lays them in the soil. So you'll see what she does here is she extends her abdomen deep into the soil, lays a pod of eggs, which is typically 70 to 100 eggs, surrounds them in a frothy sort of substance, and within that frothy substance is a water-soluble compound which we know originates in what are known as her accessory glands, her reproductive accessory glands. And we know that this chemical is effective only if it's applied within the first couple of hours after the eggs are laid. And such that, if you do a very simple experiment, if you take a mother of solitarius rearing, she'll produce behaviorally solitarius hatchlings. Similarly, gregarious mothers will produce gregariously behaving hatchlings. If you take the foam from a gregarious mother and you add it to the eggs of a solitarious female within a couple of hours of their being laid, then you'll end up 10 days or a week later when the eggs hatch, producing gregarious hatchlings. Similarly, if you wash this foam off the eggs laid by a gregarious female within the first couple of hours, and let them incubate and hatch, you'll produce animals that are behaviourally solitarious. If you re-add the extract, having washed it off, you'll re-gregorise the hatchlings. So the mother has this control, this chemical control over this, the behavioural state of her hatchlings. Okay, now that's something about mechanism. What we know, therefore, is that physical contact is critical, that it acts very quickly to gregorise both the individual within its own lifetime and also that this can accumulate across generations. There's a transgenerational component. What we can then do is to take that information and put it into a context where we can ask the question, well, let's look at the influence of those sorts of mechanisms on populations of locusts in environments. And so far what we've done is to take locusts and put them into boxes or put them on their own, and obviously in the real world that doesn't happen. And the way that locusts must be brought together or dispersed will be to do with the distribution in the environment of resources. And so we began with a very simple experiment where we put 10 solitary locusts into an arena where we altered the number of resource sites. And we used 3 different resources. In this case, favourable warm spots, these are little heat lamps. There was either a single one or multiple warm spots, or there was a single food plant, or there were multiple food plants, or there was a single perch, or there were multiple perches. And we left the animals in those environments for 4 hours and measured their behaviour at the beginning and the end. And what you'll find is that if you measured them at the beginning, they were all behaving solitariously, as you'd expect. But their behaviour at the end, after 4 hours, depended on how many resources they had available. So if they only had a single perch, then by 4 hours, all 10 locusts were sitting on the same perch, and they were behaviourally highly gregarious. If you gave them multiple perches, they typically sit on their own perch and remain behaviourally solitarious. If you gave them a single food, they'd be behaviourally gregarious at the end, all sitting cheek by jowl eating on that same food plant. If you gave them multiple food plants, they'd all be sitting on their own, hidden away from each other, and they would be remaining solitarious in their behaviour. Similarly, a single warm spot was more gregarising than having multiple warm spots. And if you collapse all of those data across treatments, you find that you can explain the pattern of results simply in terms of the number of minutes during the 4 hours that an individual spent within a body length of another individual locust. So you've just essentially shown that the knowledge we have about the mechanisms of phase change does translate into this very simple population level behaviour. If the world brings you together against your predisposition to avoid each other, because there's only a single resource site, then you're going to bump into each other, gregarise, aggregate, and you'll end up behaviourally gregarious. If the environment allows you to maintain your distance from each other, then you won't.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it clear in those experiments, do you know that in the experiments, the mechanism for the phase change is the tactile one, or could it also be the combination of the sight and olfaction?
It could be both.
Okay.
Yeah. and almost certainly it is, because under real circumstances, you obviously both see, smell, and have physical contact. Yeah. But the critical thing there is that it's a close response. If you did the same plot, but you had time spent within, you know, a longer distance, the whole pattern breaks down. So you can test that hypothesis through a data analysis. Now, what we next did, and Matthew Collett is in the audience. He was the PhD student at the time who we recruited to start the individual-based modelling program. What we then did was to say, okay, we know that the rules whereby phase change occurs, its temporal dynamics. Let's start to explore the relationship between the amount of resource in the environment, the way that resource is distributed in the environment, and the number of locusts in the environment. They're the 3 sort of key parameters that you might consider. And so Matthew built models that actually incorporated individual locusts in a simulated world which were behaving according to the rules of phase change that we knew from experiment. And in that way, we're able to actually start exploring the relationship between those things. How is food dispersed? What is the abundance of food? What is the number of locus? How do those three things interact? And this is just one example where we had a fixed amount of food in the distribution, and it was either distributed in a highly dispersed manner or in a highly clumped manner. And what we did then was to decant into the model increasing numbers of locusts and see how that increase in population density affected the phase state of the population. And what you'll see is if the food resources were dispersed and scattered within the environment, then you could increase population density substantially without causing a radical shift in phase change in the population. It would tend to remain solitarious. However, as soon as you got to a critical level of clumpiness in the food distribution, a very small increase in population density would cause a rapid change in the behavioral phase state towards gregariousness.
These are model consequences?
These are model consequences, exactly. So, and which we then went on to test, but I'll come to that in a second. Another interesting thing we did was to actually say, all right, let's take out repulsion and attraction as two behavioral components in the model, but allow the locus still to phase change and their other characteristics and see what happens. And as you probably would expect, if you allow attraction and repulsion, the two behavioral characteristics of the two phase states, then you sharpen up the relationship between population phase state and, in this case, the degree of clumpiness of resources in the environment. And that's because at high levels of resource dispersion, low values on this axis, repulsion serves to inhibit phase change. Animals avoid each other, hence don't get brought together, hence don't phase change. But once you get beyond a certain amount of resource clumpiness, then the animals do interact with each other inevitably because they need to feed. That causes them to become attracted rather than repelled, and the net result is that that becomes a more critical function. And it turns out then that what behavior is doing is coupling a whole suite of continuous traits that I showed you earlier, which have different time courses and different underlying mechanisms, and turning them into what's functionally a threshold trait at the level of the population and also at the level of the individual animal. And to address that question I just had a second ago, we went on to take the predictions of that model and to test them in the laboratory, and also to test them in field environments, and this is in Morocco, and find that we had very close concordance with the predictions of the model and actually what locusts do, real locusts do, both in the field and in the laboratory. And we've done field experiments not only in Morocco but also in Mauritania. Emma Deplan, two speakers hence, has been there, done some of that critical field work I just mentioned. Ian Cousin has also spent time in this tent in Mauritania in a large sandstorm, having eaten a rather unsavoury meal of camel entrails, and I think you were in there for a week, wasn't it, Ian?
2 months.
You were confined to your tent for at least a week.
Yeah.
But he had regular excursions out of the tent, but we won't speak about that. Now, so far I've considered locusts and their interactions with their environment and each other at a very local scale. And obviously a major aim of the whole program is to scale up to larger, ultimately, hopefully, landscape scales, and that's something that we're actively working on now. But if you think about it from the bottom up, the problem is that we, let's say, have a little bunch of locusts within a local habitat patch who have gregarized as a result of the distribution and abundance of resources and the numbers of locusts within that patch. And if that is actually to start to scale up into a bigger and bigger locust outbreak, or bigger and bigger band of locusts, you will need this group to leave that patch of habitat synchronously and to move en masse with directed motion, such that they end up invading a neighbouring patch and recruiting the locusts that are there. If they don't do these things, if they left the patch in a scattered manner over time, or they didn't move together collectively, from what we already know, they'd start to solitarize, and that would wind back in a positive feedback towards solitarization. The whole thing wouldn't catch fire, if you like. So we need those two things, synchronicity and also movement en masse with directed motion. Now, synchronicity might be imposed, and Emma's going to show us some data indicating this, by animals actually interacting with each other as coupled oscillators. So they have their own intrinsic behavioral rhythm of feeding and resting and feeding and resting, and if they can couple with the activities of the others, if they serve to phase set each other, you could end up with synchronicity of behavior within a group through endogenous processes. And the other source of synchronicity is obviously exogenous. And you see, for example, this is one of Ian's photographs demonstrating a very common phenomenon early in the morning. Locusts descend from their roost in this particular plant overnight, and they sit together very close, jostling each other in warm patches of sunshine, warming up sufficiently to then feed and then start marching. So that's the synchronicity. What about moving collectively en masse? Now that's something that Ian is going to talk to us about in his lecture, which follows from mine, and he's going to tell us particularly about how we've started to use self-propelled particle models to explore this. So I won't spoil his thunder anymore by assuming that. Instead, I'm going to divert entirely to a different story. This is a really exciting story. This is something that actually it's quite apt. You're the first audience to hear it. It comes out in PNAS tomorrow, and it's causing a lot of interest at the moment amongst the scientific press. This is a different animal. These are Mormon crickets. These are animals that form huge marching bands, not in Africa, but in the west of North America. Utah, Idaho particularly. And they share features with locusts, and I'm going to come back to locusts because they illustrate a key point that we hadn't really understood about locust biology, about collective movement in locusts. So, we spent a couple of weeks last summer in the field in Idaho, southern Idaho and northern Utah. Here it is, this is the field site. And we were watching these vast swarms of marching crickets. And it had been shown by our co-worker, Greg Sword, who isn't here, unhappily, he's recently moved to Sydney, that these bands of crickets are important to crickets because they serve as an anti-predator strategy. If you isolate these crickets from a band and radio collar them, you come back a day or so later and all you find is empty radio collars. They get eaten by predators. So the reason for forming bands in the first instance is an anti-predator strategy. But why do they migrate? Why do they show this mass movement? What's the point of that? Well, you might predict from any other mass movement of animals that it's something to do with resource depletion. Locusts, for example, strip the habitat bare as they go, as you saw on that very first video. But that isn't the case with Mormon crickets. They don't strip the habitat bare. In fact, it's very hard to see where they've been, apart from vast quantities of Mormon cricket feces, which are scattered about the vegetation. You wouldn't really know that they've been there. So if it does occur, resource depletion has to be more selective. There must be something a little bit more specific about the habitat that's driving these movements. Well, what might those limiting resources be? It could be protein, it could be non-protein energy, typically carbohydrate for these sorts of animals, it could be micronutrients, or it could be water. Well, if you watch them, what you find is that you'll see them commonly eating high-protein plant parts, things like seeds or flower heads. You'll also see them eating carrion or soil soaked in cattle urine, or indeed experimenter urine. And here's an example of, this is a recently run over jackrabbit. Here are Mormon crickets busily eating that jackrabbit. This had ears that went out about there about an hour ago, so they've just chewed its ears off. They also eat each other. Fiercely cannibalistic. In fact, one cricket, which is about as big as your thumb, by the way, to give you a scale, can eat another cricket of exactly the same size in a single meal. And that's a pretty extraordinary feat. I don't know of any other animal that can do that. Now, that causes problems because when they get run over as they cross the road, the ones behind them stop to eat them and then get run over. You have a massive slurry of crickets and cars spin out, and it causes real problems. Actually, it's probably the major economic problem posed by these creatures. So we went into the field and we asked the question, well, what do you want from your habitat? What are the limiting nutrients in your world? So here's Ian, and there's Pat Lorch, and there's me, and Greg Sword was taking the photograph. And what we did was to place dishes containing chemically defined artificial foods in front of the marching band of crickets, and then videoed to see which ones they particularly wanted to stop at. And if we watch this video, you'll see what's going on. Now, there are four dishes here. This dish here contains both protein and carbohydrate mixed with cellulose and micronutrients. This one contains just carbohydrate but no protein. This one, protein but no carbohydrate. And the one on the right, no, it's not running. Oh, damn, it was working before. Oh, well. Oh, there you go, sorry. And that's a zero diet, which just has cellulose. And you watch what they do and see if you can work out what you think they're going for. Remember, too, that crickets can taste with their feet. Protein. PC contains both protein and carbohydrate, but only half the concentration. That's 42% protein. That one is 21% protein with 21% carbohydrate. That's 42% carbohydrate, and that's the cellulose base. They're after protein. There's a huge difference in their response to these diets according to purely the protein content. So if you look at essentially, the ability of these dishes to stop a marching cricket, protein stopped most, the high protein diet, the 21% protein diet, the next amount, and they didn't care less about carbohydrate. So they're selectively feeding for protein. But are they obligate protein feeders, or perhaps they're just suffering recent deprivation because of the habitat? Well, to answer that question, what we did was we took individual crickets, put them in their own little boxes, left them in the field with both a protein dish and a carbohydrate dish, and let them mix their own diet. And what you find is over the first day, they pig out on protein. They eat a substantially protein-based diet. But thereafter, they reduce their intake of protein and eat what's much more typically a cricket grasshopper sort of diet, which is one that's slightly biased in carbohydrate. Which indicates that actually they're suffering recent deprivation. They're not habitually requiring very high levels of protein. It's just that they've been recently deprived by there not being enough in their habitat. And if you allow them to have enough, they reduce their consumption of it once they've satiated that requirement. Turned out not only to be protein, but also salt. Here's a living histogram which shows different concentrations of salt from 0.125, 0.25, 0.5, 1 and 2 molar on cotton swabs. And what you find is that they have a very strong predilection for 0.25 molar sodium chloride. nice dose response curve here. It's not the water they're after, it's salt, and it's salt at intermediate concentrations. Lo and behold, the most stimulating concentration is the concentration you typically find in the blood of other crickets. Now, the most obvious source of protein and salt in your habitat is other crickets. So does this mean that our crickets are actually on a forced march? They need to find more protein and salt, and if they don't keep marching, they get eaten. Well, we can start making predictions. We can make the first prediction that if they stop moving, they're going to get eaten. Now, that's a simple one to test. What we did here is we placed either very freshly dead crickets or live ones that were glued down. These are small boy experiments. There were four small boys. And what we found was that if they were freshly dead, they were eaten. The latency of attack was almost immeasurable. They were just first contact, they were eaten. If they were able to fend other crickets off, particularly with their back legs, then they survived a bit longer, but they still got eaten. We then went a little bit further and tethered them a fishing line and compromised their capacity to kick other crickets off by pulling either one or both back legs off, which is a real little boy experiment. And what we found was that if they were dead, lying there, they were eaten. 100% of them were eaten over the next couple of hours. If they had neither of their back legs, but they could otherwise run around in a circle on their tether, most of them were eaten. If they had one back leg, many of them survived. And if they had both back legs, some of them were eaten, but most of them survived. So they could fend off other crickets with their back legs. And if you looked in real bands and measured the frequency with which you found animals missing back legs, a very small number had only one back leg, and none at all had no back legs. So the majority had both back legs. You need your back legs to kick others off, and otherwise you're going to be compromised and you're dead meat. The other prediction we could make is that if you were to satiate the animals in protein and salt, you should reduce their tendency to cannibalize and perhaps inhibit their tendency to march independent of other crickets. Well, to answer that question, what we did was we took a test cricket, put it in a bucket with one of those same four artificial foods I mentioned before for a 5-hour period, and then we threw in a victim and we measured how much of the victim got eaten. And it turned out that protein deprivation, now what this graph here shows is the cases where cannibalism exceeded the value on this axis, a value of no damage all the way up to every single skerrick of the animal eaten, not a thing left. Now what you'll see is if the animals had been fed only on the carbohydrate or the zero diet, neither of which contained protein, then the majority of them ate at least half of the victim, and some of them, a substantial number, ate the entire thing. If, however, they were protein replete by having been given the two protein-containing foods, then that tendency was substantially and significantly reduced. Similarly, if they were deprived of extra salt or given extra salt, you found that the salt-replete animals were also less likely to cannibalize. So both protein and salt feeding reduced cannibalism. And it also happened, if you looked at individual crickets on their own, and fed one of these three diets, then basically protein satiation reduced their tendency to locomote, such that protein-deprived crickets spent 50% more time walking than those that had been fed a diet containing protein. So, in summary, what's happening with these crickets? Well, they initially form bands as an anti-predator strategy. Once they've formed these bands, they have to keep moving to find new resources, particularly protein and salt, and to avoid being eaten. The tendency to move itself is a function of your own nutritional state, particularly your protein state, and mass movement is an indirect consequence of conspecifics coming from behind and forcing you onwards. And it really is a forced march, something which most models of collective movement haven't considered. So typically you have these zones of attraction, orientation, and repulsion, but this is a new element which, at least in this system, seems to be critically important. Is it also important in locusts? Well, if that's true in the locust system, collective movement is driven by cannibalism, we would expect that if you were somehow to reduce the push from behind by the cricket, the locust, I'm going to get my two insects mixed up now, then you should break down coordinated movement. Well, to do that, we took advantage of an observation I made when I was a PhD student many years ago. I found that if I sectioned the nerve cord and numbed the back end of the animal and put them together in a group, something I was doing for an entirely different reason, I came back the next morning and my animals had eaten each other's back ends off, and that seemed to be an unpleasant thing at the time. It wasn't what I wanted, but nevertheless it turned out to be a very useful device in this context. So what we did here was to reduce the sensation of the animal, its ability to detect others coming from behind, by cutting the nerve cord, this is the central nervous system of the locust, up at the very anterior part of the abdomen. Now, if you cut those nerves there, the animal can't feel its back end. Hence, if somebody came from behind, it couldn't respond, or wouldn't know they were there. And then we measured the behavior of individuals on their own to see whether that operation, as compared with a sham operation, compromised their general behavior, because that was a possibility, of course. And if so or if not, we then put them in groups to see how their interactions with each other were influenced by having the back end numbed. And the way that we quantified this, now this is probably stealing from Ian, he'll show you this one again for sure, was to place our animals in a circular arena, which is a bit like a Mexican hat, have them moving around, and then use Ian's very clever software for tracking individuals and hence quantifying their interactions with each other and their collective movement. And you can see them here marching around and around in a circle around that arena. Well, what happened? Well, it turned out that if you looked at individual locusts, cutting their nerve cord as compared with the sham control didn't have any effect. So if you looked at the proportion of time an individual spent walking or its walking speed, there was no difference. There was no effect of having cut the nerve cord. Now that's encouraging. It means that the operation itself isn't compromising the animal behaviorally. But if you put them in a group, what you find is that there is now a substantial effect. The nerve-sectioned animals continue to spend about the same proportion of their time walking as if they were exactly on their own, whereas those in groups, without their nerve cut, the sham-operated animals, are now starting to show collective marching. They're moving much more, they're spending more time walking, and they're tending to march. So it turns out that that's because, if we break that down across time, of the pressure from behind, other individuals coming from behind, being reduced by the animals just not sensing the fact that others are there. So this shows how the control and the nerve cut animals over time change their behavior. And what you'll see is that very, very early on, very soon after being introduced into the arena, the animals are demonstrating this marked difference in behavior. So they're collectively moving or they're not according to the presence of stimuli detected by the individuals to do with animals coming from behind, potential cannibals coming from behind. Well, are they cannibals, like crickets? The answer is yes, they are. So what we have here is the proportion of injured locusts within the group at the end of the experiment, and you'll see that those with the nerve cut are substantially more likely to have been injured than those with the sham operation. And very typically, you find them walking along with no back end at all. And you do even find daisy chains where they're sitting happily eating the locust abdomen in front, unaware that they're having theirs eaten at the same time. So in summary, what have we got? Well, it turns out that highly coordinated insect swarms, such as these locusts and crickets, certainly aren't cooperative. What we have is high densities of animals as a result of their interactions with the environment, depleting particular resources in the environment, leading to specific nutrient deprivation. And because the animals themselves provide the most abundant way of achieving nutrient balance, to reduce injury, the individuals have to keep moving. And the safest way to move is parallel with the motion of others. So really, bands, in, at least in these two species, are essentially a forced march driven by cannibalism. And, of course, habitat features, as we saw earlier in the phase change example in locusts, habitat features to do with the distribution and abundance of resources. And we also know from work that Emma Day planned in, the quality, nutritional quality of those resources will determine whether locusts come together and gregarize. Having done so, those same sorts of factors are going to determine whether and where they move collectively. And we think, at least, that this really does change the view both of how these sorts of collective phenomena occur at the mechanistic level and why they occur at a functional and evolutionary level. And I'd just like to thank a whole stack of collaborators over the years, both in Oxford, where I was until a year ago when I moved to the University of Sydney, and various collaborators, the active ones who are involved in some of the work that I've just spoken about at the moment are in red, and Emma will pick up some of the story in her talk in 2 talks' time. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.